Mr. Zimmerman, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. We have a new door we're using because of some work being done on the Capitol, and it is a little bit more public. So you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jim Zimmerman, and I'm here representing the appellant in this case. The issue before the court doesn't have anything to do with the reasonableness of the fee in this case. Mr. St. John isn't arguing with any of us about whether the fee charged is reasonable. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. The fee was stipulated to, and it was agreed upon. In fact, Mr. St. John and his ex-wife actually traveled to Lincoln and testified at the hearing before the workers' comp judge, and they testified and never raised an issue about whether the fee itself was reasonable or not. Therefore, when you look at the Nebraska Rules of Professional Conduct 3-501.5, where it talks about the reasonableness of a fee, and it goes through the 8 factors that you're supposed to consider if there's a dispute between the client and the attorney as to the amount of the fee, then, you know, if there had been a dispute as to what the fee was, then that would be the case. If you look at the Houtman O'Brien Turco case, which was also relied upon by the appellee in this case, then you're back to the same situation. That was a fight between Turco and his law firm as to the value of the fee.
What was the nature of the stipulation you referred to? Who were the parties to it, and what did they stipulate to?
It was basically, as I recall, in the cop court, and there was an actual order entered that Mr. St. John would receive of the $500,000, I think about $335,000. The attorney's fee, which was $165,000, was to be held in trust until we actually had a hearing with the comp judge.
So your contention is that the client agreed that the $165,000 that was left would be a reasonable fee to be apportioned between the two competing attorney liens.
Correct.
Thank you.
So it's my contention that what you have to do is look at the Baker versus Ziskus case, because of the fact that that case specifically dealt with a situation where there was a contingent fee. That contingent fee was terminated at some point in the litigation. Another lawyer took over the case, and there was a new contingent fee. The contingent fee, well, a little bit of the history of the case. I worked with Mr. St. John for maybe a little over a year, and then he moved to Colorado Springs. And when he moved to Colorado Springs, he went there so that his ex-wife could help him out. He terminated me. I guess that's the word you would use. And he hired Bartles because she was an attorney who was licensed in Nebraska and actually lived in Colorado Springs. And then she, in turn, hired Mr. Nealon. And they worked with him for a period of January to November. And then Mr. St. John became very, very dissatisfied. As the record shows, I ran into him one day in the courthouse, asked him how things were going. He said he wanted to talk to me, and that he had fired them. And then he came to talk to me, and we prepared another more formal way of terminating their services, and that was ultimately served upon them. And then I worked on the file probably another 2.5 years after that. So if you look at Baker, Baker says that once you're contingent fee is terminated, you're only able to claim the reasonable value of the services actually rendered up to the date of termination. So you're talking about a window of January to November of the time that they actually worked on it.
And at that point, doesn't the framework of the rules of ethics come back in to determine what's reasonable?
No. I don't think so.
Well, assume that it does. Assume that it does, and explain your argument about the standard of review and the factual determination that the workers' comp court made about the proper allocation.
Well, I think what the workers' comp court did was just basically ignored everything and just said, I feel like you just ought to split the fee. I don't think he looked at the fee agreement that they actually had and considered the rules of contract law. I don't think he looked at anything under the Nebraska Rules of Professional Conduct. I think he relied a little bit, or probably on the Hauptman case, where he says, okay, if you've got a dispute as to the reasonableness of the fee, then you have to go in and the attorneys have to use all of these eight factors. So in this case, I don't think any of that's at all applicable because of the Baker versus Ziskus case that talks about you're only entitled to that portion of the time that you actually worked on the case. What was the value of the services in that narrow window?
And if we agree with you on that, is that a question of fact?
Is what a question of fact? As to whether that's the law?
No. Is it a question of fact what the amount of the reasonable value of the services during that limited period of time would be?
Well, I'm going to take the position, in order to not have to worry about, are we going to have to go back and have a huge hearing as to them coming in and having to prove exactly what they did during that period. Because in the course of the discovery, I asked them, okay, what was the total amount of time that you claim that you worked on this particular file? How many hours did you? Because if you look at their actual...
But if you're talking about their hours, aren't you talking now about the contractual provision in the Bartles and Nealon agreement that spells out what they were to get in the event of a discharge?
Yes, that's what.
And
I'm
so then we're not talking about the reasonableness factors in Hauptman O'Brien case. We're talking about a question of law interpreting the contract. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's my argument.
And what's your argument if we take the contract? What is it that Bartles and Nealon are entitled to under the contractual language?
Under the contractual line, it says, should a client choose to discharge attorneys prior to final settlement or judgment, client agrees to pay attorneys a fee equal to 33 1/3 of the gross amount received or an hourly basis of $175 per hour for his or her time and, in addition, $75 per hour for paralegal time from the date of this agreement to the date of discharge. So that's the narrow window. You got the date of the agreement, the date of discharge, or the above percentage of attorney's fee from any settlement offer made prior to discharge, whichever is greater. So had there been, say, a settlement offer of $200,000 made before they were terminated, according to this, they would be entitled to a third of that $200,000, or if they can prove how many hours they worked on it based on $175 an hour or their paralegal's time, you figure that up and they get whichever's greater. That's what this agreement says. The evidence in the record shows that they had, well, each of them had claimed about 80 hours worth of time, and there was some paralegal time involved. And so we actually made an offer to them to pay them the $32,682.50 plus $2,500 of their expenses. That's what that would come to. And we've said, you can have it. And so we don't need to go back and argue or have them prove, although according to Mr. St. John and his ex-wife, the value of the services provided, particularly by Ms. Bartles, was almost nothing because she did nothing that they wanted her to do.
How are you reading the contract? It's in the disjunctive, whichever is greater?
Well, that's only if there had been a settlement offer made prior. That's only what that means, because it has to do, if there was a settlement offer made prior to the date of discharge.
Okay. During the engagement?
During the engagement. Okay. If there was a settlement during that narrow window.
Thank you.
Then their agreement says we get 33 1/3 of that, or if we can show you what time we spent on it at 175 and 75, whichever of those two figures come out the highest, that's what they're entitled to be paid. But that's only in the situation Where that one-third comes in is if there was a prior offer. Other than that, then they are stuck, based upon the language of their agreement, to the $175 an hour and the $75 for the paralegals. And so you just say, okay, how many hours did you work? One said 81, one said 80, a few hours of this, and so you total it up and it comes to the $32,000. And that's what we're saying, that's what they're entitled to.
Your position is there was no settlement offer prior to their discharge, correct?
Well, it's not my position. There wasn't one.
Fair enough. But there was something, though, where there was a stipulation to something, an award of temporary benefits.
Mister, if you look at the record, at no time were his indemnity benefits ever in question. After he hired them, Ms. Bartles was supposed to prepare an agreement that covered mileage, because after he moved to Colorado Springs, they were supposed to get him a primary care physician, change his prescriptions and all that sort of stuff, and they never did it. So he's driving from Colorado Springs to Scotts Bluff, which is 616 miles round trip, every month to see his primary doctor, get his prescriptions, and so there's mileage involved. They also were claiming some medical expenses, and if you look at the total record, his ex-wife worked with Ms. Bartles and said, you're wrong, this is wrong, here, I'm going to outline it in red for you, you're wrong. Never got any of that done. So he continued to do that, and he ultimately came back to Scotts Bluff, and that's where I met him in the courthouse, and that's when I took over the case. And from then on, I did a tremendous amount of work for him. He had the hyperbaric treatment. That was a very highly experimental treatment that I was able to convince the carrier to go ahead and pay for. He was traveling back and forth from Boulder. I took care of all of his prescriptions, his mileage. As the record shows, I worked with Dr. Sisson to convince the carrier that when they said, well, why don't you have the stimulator put in, he didn't want to do it because he was scared to death of his blood clotting and his blood thinner. And so we were able to convince the insurance company with Dr. Sisson that that was not an unreasonable decision to make. There were all kinds of things that we did. We got the company that manufactures his Xarelto to put him on their program so he didn't have to pay for it anymore, $4,000 a year, which allowed us to ultimately come up with a settlement figure.
Mr. Zimmerman, I think your time is... Okay.
Thank
is up. Thank you very much. Mr. Nyland, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Monty Nyland. I practice law for my office in Scotts Bluff, and today I'm here representing the appellees. The trial court decision should be affirmed in this case because the trial court's factual findings are supported by evidence in the record and are not clearly wrong. So, in this case, the trial court conducted a hearing. The trial judge saw and heard the witnesses who testified. He reviewed the exhibits, and he made factual findings. Specifically, the trial court found that the agreed upon attorney's fee, which was being held in trust, should be equally divided between the appellant and the appellees because the evidence did not support valuing one attorney's efforts and services over the other attorney's.
Assume we agree with you that there's no evidence of clear error in the trial court's weighing of the attorney's respective contributions. Do we still have to reckon with the contractual language in your agreement that sets forth what you were entitled to in the event of a discharge prior to the conclusion of the case?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is no, because this court has consistently said since Houtman O'Brien versus Turco 2007 that the primary inquiry in an attorney's fee issue is reasonableness. And it goes on to say that the reasonableness factors are those that are set forth in Section 3-501 sub 5 of the Nebraska Rules of Professional Conduct.
So if you enter into an agreement with a client and the agreement entitles you to a $1,000 flat fee, but you provide outstanding representation, such that a court might look at it and say, wow, I mean, if I look at this reasonably, this was $10,000 worth of legal work. Is it your contention that you can get, under the reasonable factors, a lawyer can recover more than they would be entitled to recover under their contract?
That is not my position, Your Honor. In this case, the distinction is clearly that the appellant, the appellees, and the client all entered into a written stipulation that was filed with the Nebraska Workers' Compensation Court as part of the amended application for lump sum settlement. That written stipulation set the total amount of attorney's fees at $165,000, and that $165,000 also included the total amount that would be awarded, if any, for costs and expenses.
How does that inform the contract?
Your Honor, my understanding is that at the time that this stipulation between the appellees, the appellant, and the client was entered into, the fee agreements as between clients and lawyers were no longer operative. At that point in time, it became a matter for the workers'
compensation. So your position is the contractual arrangements were abandoned based on a stipulation of value of service.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
So I keep wandering back to a jurisdictional question in my mind, so I'm going to ask it to you. If I understand everyone correctly today, the claimant in this case, the employee, stipulated that $165,000 would be a reasonable fee for all of his lawyers.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there's no dispute about the reasonableness of the $165,000. The real dispute here is between two lawyers over allocation or apportionment of that $165,000 fee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
If the dispute is between two lawyers over the proper allocation of a fund for attorney fees, is that something that the Workers' Compensation Court has jurisdiction to hear, or is that something that's a little more like a 48-118 issue that ought to be in front of a district court judge?
I don't know the answer to that. I had not thought of it. My hazy recollection is that we do have a statute that says that, or case law, I don't remember, that says the Workers' Compensation Court is entitled to determine fees that are the result of services performed in the court.
So I think in Foster versus Bryan LGH, this court concluded that the Compensation Court has jurisdiction to decide fee disputes arising out of perfected attorney liens, but that case just involved the claimant and a lawyer who had been terminated. It wasn't a separate dispute, was it, between two lawyers?
I do not recall the facts of that case. However, that is the case that I was thinking of. It's not a statute, and that was the case that caused me to insert into the, it would have been the stipulated award in a work comp case, that at some later date, the Workers' Compensation Court would determine the amount of the attorney's fees, the lien that is referred to in the Foster case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There are no more questions. We would again respectfully suggest to the court that the trial court's order should be affirmed because there is no, trial court was not clearly wrong.
If you are limited, if your recovery is limited to the terms of the contract, can you take me through your argument as to what amount you would be entitled to and why under the discharge provisions of your agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the discharge provisions of the agreement, which are paragraph 8, that was drafted such, again, briefly, the history of this case. I believe that Ms. Bartles and I were the fourth set of lawyers to represent Mr. St. John. There was some thought that we may be replaced with another lawyer. And so the attempt was made, imperfect though it may have been, to craft paragraph 8 such that a total attorney's fee of one-third would be awarded, and then whichever attorneys are claiming entitlement to some attorney's fee would share that one-third. It is not in addition to. There was no contention at any point by any lawyer in this case that Mr. St. John should pay multiple one-third attorney's fees. And so that one-third attorney's fee would be divided as between all attorneys claiming the right to some fees as a result of misrepresenting Mr. St. John.
Is there anything in the agreement that says that? That says the idea that the four different lawyers would split the one-third fee in some way?
No, Your Honor, but that would be the preamble, which is sometimes left out, to 3-501.5. A lawyer shall not make an agreement for, charge, or collect an unreasonable fee or an unreasonable amount for expenses. So in other words, it's unethical not only to try to collect that fee, it's unethical to write a fee agreement that suggests that that's what will be done. We took great pains in both the email communications that are in the record with the appellant and at the hearing on attorney's fee with Judge Hofford to point out the fact that there was no effort to collect multiple fees, that the parties would be required
the
to
math,
share.
Well, the math won't work.
It will not work. It will not work. If there are no more questions, thank you all.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? Not so. The next case of the day then.